Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Dialogue Tree. Today I speak with John Sharp, Associate Professor of Games and Learning at Parsons, the new school for design. John curated the recent exhibit Space War, Video Games Blast Off at the Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, New York, which charted the origins and development of space combat video games. He also gave the keynote address at Indiecade East this past February, where he connected the punk DIY philosophy with indie developers. We speak about that, as well as Space War, and what a more punk attitude could do for the indie game scene. So John Sharp, thank you very much for joining me today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
I asked you on primarily to talk about your Indiecade East talk from February. And I found that talk really interesting because it sort of drew out a lot of the parallels between the early days of game development, as you saw with your creation of the Space War exhibit at the Museum of the Moving Image, which is closing, I think, tomorrow.
Yep.
And also the current indie scene, so the current indie game development scene and the punk scene, primarily the 80s and I guess early 90s. And you sort of trace these three disparate scenes all back to this concept of DIY. Could you go into a little bit more?
Sure. As I talked a little bit about in the talk for Space War, as an educator and a game designer, Space War has always been something I've been quite interested in. I have 3 degrees in art history, so I tend to look at the world from a sort of through a historical lens often. For things I don't understand or things I'm curious about, I'll often look to the past to try to understand, you know, how things were done. And so Space War was a sort of obvious place for me to begin, you know, this first game. And there's a pretty good amount of information still out there about it. Most of the guys who worked on it are still alive. And so probably for the last decade, through teaching and my own research, I've spent a lot of time trying to learn about it. And I've been fascinated by the degree to which they model the development process that we use today in creating games in terms of prototyping and lots of play testing, working in teams. Is just so much about it that just really models exactly what we do. But one of the things I was most struck by, I guess, was the DIY attitude, the do-it-yourself attitude that those guys had, which didn't just pertain to Space War, but it's how they approached everything. You know, the main developer of Space War, Steve Russell, was also instrumental in creating the Lisp programming language used for artificial intelligence. One of the other guys, Peter Sampson, was one of the first people to sort of synthesize music through these early computers. So these attitudes were just pervasive in the way they approached computing. And I think it's a little bit hard for us to wrap our heads around in some ways because we're used to computers sort of doing a lot for us. And even if you're a programmer, there's all kinds of classes and libraries and examples you can find on the internet. But for those guys, they were basically at ground zero. There wasn't a lot for them to draw upon. They were having to invent everything from scratch. And so it was really necessary to have that kind of roll up your sleeves, get your hands dirty, and do it for yourself attitude. And I just find it just the whole thing to be really inspiring, everything that they were doing.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about Space War as a game and as a development concept is that, there really wasn't any sort of end goal in mind. They just wanted to make something to play themselves, basically. And I think in a similar fashion to, you know, how a lot of the early sort of punk and hardcore stuff started getting going, you know, kids and young people just sort of picking up instruments and not even necessarily knowing how to play them and learning as they went and creating this scene. So, do you, in your research with Space War, do you see any sort of, was there any sort of end goal in mind with them, or was it just sort of, we just want to do this and what it spawned sort of was surprising?
I mean, their end goal was essentially to do a better demonstration of the capabilities of the PDP-1 computer that the university had received. There was one particular demonstration that had already been created that everyone referred to as the Minskytron, because Marvin Minsky, one of the early pioneers of AI, had produced what was essentially a animation that kind of looked like an Etch-a-Sketch, like an animated Etch-a-Sketch, if you can imagine. And it was kind of the Space War guys thought, well, yeah, that's kind of cool to look at for, you know, 30 seconds or a minute, but then it gets kind of boring. And so they set about trying to figure out how to make a better demo to showcase this, you know, cutting edge piece of hardware they had access to. And so three of the guys went off and formed what they called the Hingham Institute study group for space warfare or something like that. And they wrote a little manifesto that they called the Theory of Computer Toys. And it's 3 points in the manifesto, and I'm drastically paraphrasing here, but essentially they boiled down to, you have to maximize the technology, push it as hard as you can. You need to make it interactive, and meaning that every time somebody uses it within a consistent framework, they have a varied experience. And then ultimately they wanted it to be a sort of pleasurable aesthetic experience. And they felt like games were the perfect media, the perfect kind of cultural form to create. And so from there, we have this little manifesto that guided them. They also happened to be incredible sci-fi fans, and you know, thus spawned Space War, which they felt like was a superior demonstration of the capabilities of this computer.
Yeah, I find that interesting, because those 3 points don't seem to be the guiding philosophy of indie game development nowadays. I think that's more the guiding philosophy of the sort of, you know, quote unquote AAA titles. So yeah. What do you make of that? Do you think that Space War obviously was an indie title, if we can use that term even then? I mean, this was 1962, so that term really wouldn't have made any sense to them.
No.
The term video game might not even have made any sense to them. Well, but
they called it a computer toy, right? I love that before we even had a name, we even had stumbled upon or agreed upon video game as a term, they were already thinking about these things.
So I'm wondering if you can comment on the usefulness of those 3 points, that theory, in terms of indie game development, and you know, do you think that those still have some usefulness to indie games?
Sure, I certainly do. I mean, I think with the exception of the first one, it's about maxing out the technology. I think the other 2 points are incredibly relevant. I mean, you know, I think of myself as being part of the sort of New York scene of the indie game world, which has a very systems-oriented approach to games. And I think that second tenet about it being interactive and being, you know, inside a sort of designed framework allowing unique experiences, that very much is the spirit of the way I think folks like Eric Zimmerman and Frank Lance, even Tracy Fullerton, there are many, many designers operating on the indie world that take that same kind of approach. I think that second tenet of the theory of computer toys really embodies what's wonderful about games, I think, and what makes games different. Whether you're operating at an indie level, you're, you know, a guy or a gal sitting alone working on a game, or you're, you know, some large corporation, some large studio, that's what really makes games interesting, that you're giving players an opportunity to have a sort of unique experience within the sort of designed confines. So you can make a twitchy game for them, you can make a contemplative game for them, but inside of that space, there's opportunity to make the experience their own. So I think that's extremely relevant.
Yeah, and you saw that with you know, even the Space War team. They were thinking about the player even back then. And you know, do you think that you know, this may be a different question, but especially with, I think, the more commercial titles that are coming out nowadays, and within the past 5 or 10 years, there's been this sort of easing into the experience, and indie titles perhaps are not as overly you know, player friendly, I guess, you know, if we can use that term. So how, what do you think is sort of the best approach for that?
I mean, I feel like, I think AAA games and even to some extent, some of the sort of, higher end, more polished, larger budget indie games have fallen into this trap of putting too many training wheels on the play experience. And you know, I think that robs players of their agency to some degree, right? It's robbing them of their ability to make the play experience their own. You know, there's a fine line between, you know, a game that's completely unforgiving and unapologetic about its opacity in terms of learning to use the controls or what exactly the player is trying to do. But at the same time, I think every time a decision point is reached, flashing something up on the screen that tells you exactly what to do, that's taking away a player's agency. Now, I think there are certain kinds of games that you know, have that level of complexity that require a, you know, an entry point, but I don't think they all do.
Do you think that tension could be due to the fact that you know, a lot of AAA games are sort of, I think, viewed as by players even as more authored experiences, and I think the indie scene is more, there's a lot more room for experimentation and a lot more room for games as a playground.
Well, I mean, I guess my take on that is that a lot of sort of the AAA games going after the hardcore gamer or whatever term you'd want to use for that, they kind of found themselves painting themselves into a corner, and that they were making these games that required an incredible amount of prior knowledge and a certain sort of refined skill set and way of thinking that were required to kind of gain access to the game, right? And so, I think the sort of hand-holding intros, if you will, were put in place to mitigate that, right? To allow broader audiences to be able to play these games as well, because there's only so many people who, you know, are incredibly adept at playing games that require your mastery of all 17 buttons on an Xbox controller, let's say. So that's kind of my take on where that came from.
So the earliest days of game development, you know, starting with Space War, it took place in an academic context. And, you know, today's indie games, I think, are much more diffuse than that. Obviously, people are making games in an academic context, and they're you know, a lot of examples, even in New York, you know, at Parsons where you teach, and NYU, Frank Lance, you mentioned. Mm-hmm. How do you think that affects indie games?
The whole kind of academic side of it?
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, one of the sort of, let's say, outputs or purposes of academia is research. And there happens to be at this particular moment, and hopefully going forward, a number of people inside the academy that are viewing games as their area of research, right? So I think an excellent example is what Tracy Fullerton has going on out at USC in the interactive media division, that you know, she and her team worked with the artist Bill Viola to create The Night Journey, which only could have happened really inside an academic setting because of the, you know, the risks involved in working with the hardware, making that particular kind of esoteric game. You know, Tracy's now working on Walden, which is, you know, her exploration of Thoreau's book. Rich Lermichon's recently joined their faculty. He now has a team working with him on a project. And so this is our form of research. You know, Colleen and I have the things we're doing here inside of Pet Lab. We're doing projects with, you know, for example, the Red Cross. And we're right now working on this project called Data Toys, where we're trying to imagine how toys can help people better understand the systemic nature of the world. So I think what's going on in the sort of, we can call it the indie academic or academic indie scene, whatever the right phrasing might be, is really quite vital. You know, we have folks like Robert Yang, who actually just walked in the room here where I'm sitting, who is just recently graduated from our program. Before he came into the program, he was already part of the indie scene, and now we have him teaching with us. You know, and it's awesome to have folks like him having opportunity to teach, to share the work they're doing with our students, but also then having the space to kind of do their own research in our case, that often is play or games, right?
Yeah, I want to pick up on that with that word systemic that you used. You know, I think it's interesting because I think a lot of the academic indie titles or academic indie work that's happening, as you call it, is a lot more focused on systems. And I think, you know, a lot of the indie games that are coming out of the more DIY element of it, you know, the traditional someone's making a game in their bedroom kind of atmosphere,
right,
are a lot more interested in sort of this personal experience and getting across some kind of idea or narrative of their life or something they believe in. So do you think that there should be some crossover there? And what do you think that crossover should be if you do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's definite crossover. Let's use Anantropy's Dysphoria as an example, right? That's a deeply, deeply personal work about her experience as a transgendered woman. So, it's in this, Anna would hate this, but it's sort of in the spirit of Jason Rohrer and the sort of art game thing that, you know, he does, and Daniel Ben-Mergui and folks like that, or I guess better stated, they used to do. But she has a very systemic way of thinking about games, right? Like if you read her writing, like for example, she has an excellent essay she wrote on Super Mario Brothers as a kind of exemplar of level design. She's very much thinking about games in this sort of systemic way. Now, Anna may use slightly different words. She's probably going to use things like nouns and verbs. Mm-hmm. But she's essentially describing the same exact thing using slightly different terminology. She's applying it in a different way, but she's still coming from a very similar kind of space.
Yeah, since you brought up Anantropy, I do want to, you know, a lot of indie games are focused not on what traditional commercial games are focused on. Mm-hmm. And she's even described video games in this fashion. She says in her book, Rise of the Video Game Zinesters, quote, mostly video games are about men shooting men in the face, end quote. I mean, you know, sort of implying that the default action of most video games is some sort of violence, which I don't think anyone that plays video games would disagree with, at least on the commercial side.
Yeah.
Do you think there are some lessons here for video game developers and indie game developers to sort of broaden the approach of their games and sort of the verbs that players are using?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of Anna's perhaps quixotic battle against shooting, but I totally agree. It's embarrassing to me the number of games that involve male power fantasies mm-hmm. about shooting. I love games. I'm a cheerleader for games, but I'm also embarrassed by some of what goes on because I feel like it is so limiting and childish. I remember a few years ago at the at GDC and the game developers rant session, Heather Chaplin got up and essentially said that most game developers are arrested in the bodies of 14-year-old boys in terms of the things they're interested in. And I think that's true. I think we need to broaden. You know, it's as if,
why do you think that is?
Why do I think that we need to expand, or why do I think that's the mindset people are stuck in?
Why do you think that's the mindset?
I just think that's what, I think it's a sort of, that's the community of practice that many game developers come out of. That's the kinds of games that they played when they were coming up as, teenagers and college kids. That's the kind of games the companies that they got jobs at were making. It's just, it's a fairly small group of people making games for themselves and not necessarily making games for a broader community. And I think that's part of it. And I think it also has to do with there's a pretty finite set of sort of socioeconomic backgrounds and just other forms of diversity coming into the game industry. At least that's the way it was for quite a while. And so it shouldn't be surprising that there's a bunch of white guys making games for other white guys. Hmm.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because if you look at the history of video games as a commercial force, you really do see, especially in the 70s and 80s, a lot of companies being founded that we could describe as DIY and as indie and have become the mainstream. And I think in a similar way, if you look at the punk scene that came out of the 80s, I mean, you have a lot of indie record labels like Discord and SST, mm-hmm. for example, that, you know, never really had mainstream success, but they did it their own way. And so I'm wondering if you can comment on, you know, whether or not you think that indie game developers that are working now can find that same sort of financial success, or even maybe not even success, but maybe just making a living at this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is possible. I mean, I would say that the punk hardcore record label model or example is not far off, because it is true that there are some folks who are able to sustain a living and kind of keep a community of practice going. But there's also a lot of folks who don't. You know, one of the things I didn't talk about in my talk, but should I give that talk again, I'm going to dig into if I have the time, is the fact that punk also sort of churned through people. It was almost like it was a monster that needed youth to fuel itself, right? And so there's a lot of young fans, a lot of young kind of musicians get involved, and then they kind of outgrow the genre, right? And they move on with their lives and do other things. And so there's a sort of small subset that sort of sticks with it and is able to make a kind of sustainable life out of it. And I think that's kind of the same for indie game scene. I've kind of been around it now for, I don't know, about 10 years. And I've seen a couple of waves of people come and go already. And, you know, folks who have been around it longer than I have, you know, probably seen dozens of waves of sort of, youth who are excited, come in, get involved, make a couple games, and then ultimately move on because they lose interest or they aren't able to sort of see a path to sustain a life for themselves through it. For me, that's part of what's I've come to realize recently, that the sort of the academic indie scene has become one of those places where people can sort of sustain a kind of life for themselves inside the indie game community of practice.
Do you think it's more difficult, or is it the same for indie game developers nowadays to sustain some sort of living at making games as it was for punk musicians to make a living?
I think it's probably about the same in terms of the difficulty. I mean, I in some ways, I actually think it's probably easier. It's just from a day-to-day experience. I mean, a punk band, the way, at least back in the 80s and the early 90s, when I was kind of more deeply inside the scene, the way you sustained yourself is you got in a van and you drove around the country and you played shows every night somewhere, and you crashed on people's floors and you sort of got by selling t-shirts and 7-inch singles. And that's kind of how they did it. Like the band Black Flag's a great example. Henry Rollins has this wonderful book he wrote called Get in the Van, I think that's the name of it, that chronicles a year of Black Flag on the road. It was a hard life. And so in some ways, I think indie game developers might have it a little bit easier. You know, they're sitting in their bedroom doing their work.
I think, yeah, I think maybe they have it physically easier, but I'm wondering if you think they have it easier on a systemic level, because, you know, with punk bands going out on the road, you know, getting a, getting a van and just driving around the country and playing shows, you know, there was that sort of physical presence and getting their message and their music out there. Whereas I feel with, you know, with indie games and the rise of the internet, it's very difficult for some, indie game developers to even get noticed. So what do you have any, thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a struggle, I think, it's a struggle to kind of get your games out there, to sort of rise above the noise and get people to see the game. And then, you know, it's one thing just for them to be aware of it, and it's a whole other thing to get them to, you know, care enough to then download it, and it's a whole other thing to get them to care enough to look at it and pay for it, and tell their friends about it. So it is, it's certainly not a easy road to go down. You know, I think committing oneself to a life of indie development, and it, you know, indie is kind of a loose term that we use that can mean many different things. But in this case, I think we mean not having a job working for a company, but rather, you know, working for yourself to produce your own games. That's quite difficult. You know, it's not a surprise that Indie Game the Movie resonated with so many people, because that's sort of the most obvious path that people can imagine following to success, is hole up in your parents' house, or your significant other helps pay the rent, or, you know, what have you, while you pour your blood, sweat, and tears into your game. You know, the thing that's perhaps a bit of a lie for most people is not everybody's going to be Team Meat. Not everybody's going to be Phil Fish and manage to find some success out the other side. There's far more people who are putting their all into it, kind of putting themselves out on a limb, that never find that level of success and ultimately have to, you know, get a job developing websites, or, you know, working for a bank doing, you know, accounting systems or something like that.
Yeah. And I think it was Liz Ryerson who made this criticism of Indie Game the Movie in a review that she wrote. And, you know, she made the point that, you know, definitely the games in that movie are indie, but they're also all made by white guys, and they're all sort of these side-scrolling platformers, which are a very understood concept for, you know, pretty much anybody that's been paying attention to video games or has had children any time in the past 30 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you think it's in the same way that the punk scene developed bands, and some of them that actually you know, had talent and had a message, and people really resonated with their music, and they, you know, I mean, the, you know, there's a lot of bands that we could mention that sort of found some sort of commercial or even mainstream success. You know, is it just that those people in Indie Game the Movie are the sort of, you know, Black Flags and Nirvanas and those kind of things of this scene? And is that what you need to do to make a financial success as an indie game developer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a fair comparison that they are the kind of Black Flags, or, you know, certainly Team Meat seems to have hit that level. I'm not, you know, I don't know how well Fez has done for Phil and those folks, but yeah, I mean, they are the ones that have sort of made it through. John Blow would be the Nirvana, I think. Or that game company.
He was at the PlayStation 4 announcement. So, I mean, yeah, that's about as mainstream as you can get in the game space.
For sure. That kind of blew my mind. But, yeah, I mean, I think those are the sort of outliers of success. That's just, I don't think any of this is really unique to games. It's just being part of the sort of media landscape. There's very few groups, people, what have you, that manage to find the level of success. Now, I don't think you have to hit the same level of success as John Blow in order to sort of sustain a life for yourself, right? You know, he's kind of an extreme case with the breakaway success he had from Braid. But I think you can make it work at a smaller scale than that, for sure.
Can you think of any indie game developers that are making it at that small scale?
I mean, I think for a while there were companies like Area Code before they got bought up by Zynga. Mm-hmm. And they were using a model that's pretty familiar for people. They were doing some of their own work, like Drop 7 is a good example. But then they were also doing client projects, right? So they were developing games for TV shows, like their amazing Parking Wars, or that game they did about sharks, and they did one for a couple of them for MTV. So they were kind of paying their bills by making the most of client work while also still making some of their own work. I think that tends to be the most successful model for a lot of folks. But then I can think of, you know, they're not necessarily the darlings of the indie scene, but companies like Large Animal here in New York is an example of a company that's making it go. You know, they're not recognized at, you know, the Indie Game Festival, Independent Games Festival at GDC, and, you know, they're maybe not being recognized by Indiecade, but they're still doing good work. They're still sustaining a company at a small scale. So I think there are examples out there. There just aren't necessarily a lot of examples that have managed to be darlings of the indie scene. I guess another one might be the Gaijin Games guys, mm-hmm. you know, and the Bit This, Bit That games that they've been doing over the last number of years. I thought Chris's keynote at Indiecade East was interesting for the, you know, sort of the journey that Cappy Games have gone through over the last 10 or so years, where they were, you know, it's kind of amazing. It's a miracle that they actually survived to do Sword and Sorcery or some of the other, you know, successful games they've done over the last couple of years, because they were in that trap that a lot of companies fall into, or a lot of indie developers fall into, is like, okay, we're going to take on some client work so that we can keep the lights on, so that we can make our magnum opus game. And time passes and that's not happening, and you find yourself having to sort of slowly turn into a commercial game studio as opposed to the indie game studio you wanted to be. And those guys were really fortunate. They managed to turn that corner.
Yeah, I think Cappy's a really good example. I mean, if we can draw out the music parallels a bit, you know, there's this sort of concept. I don't know how true this is anymore, just because the music industry is as completely, you know, imploded and sort of restructured itself in the past, you know, 10 years or so. But there was always this idea that, you know, you make a record for the label, and then you know, that gives you the freedom to make a record for yourself. And so, is that sort of the same model there, where these companies make these games on contract for, you know, TBS or whatever, and then they can have the freedom and the money to find some time to make the games that they want to make?
I mean, I think, the model that is put forth with Cartoon Network and Adult Swim is one way it has worked, where folks like Anantropy and Mark Essen and Cactus and others have had games commissioned that end up on the Adult Swim and Cartoon Network sites, and they get paid a decent amount of money off of those, and they're able to sort of live. I think that model works pretty well for, you know, folks working by themselves creating games. I think it's a little bit more of a danger when you're, let's say, a group of maybe three or four people working together, and you start taking on contract work to pay yourselves and to keep the lights turned on and to pay for an office for yourselves while you're doing this contract work. And then you take on, you know, you're doing that so that you can make your own games. That's a really slippery slope. That was essentially the model that GameLab, Eric Zimmerman's company, had, and that ultimately proved to not work for them. You know, they end up going out of business after about a decade. Now, granted, GameLab was sort of a groundbreaking company trying to do this sort of thing much earlier than anyone else. So perhaps if Eric and Peter had founded the company a little bit later, things would have been different for them. But I know a number of different studios like that are basically wake up a decade later and they have not finished their great game they planned to make, but instead they have this portfolio of client work they've churned out. So I think there's a real danger there of never actually getting to make the games you want to make, and instead making, you know, games for toothpaste companies instead.
I wonder if you can speak to something you said at the end of your Indie Katie's talk. You made the case for more anger in the indie games space. What do you think anger accomplished for the punk scene, and what would it accomplish for indie games?
I think the anger was for the punk scene. Anger was part of the fuel that made the whole thing go, right? That there was a dissatisfaction with the live, what people saw around them in their lives, and this upset them. That was certainly my own experience as a teenager and a college student and beyond, even to this day, that there's a lot of things that make me mad that go on in the world that provide fuel in varying ways for the kinds of work I do. So I think that's something, I guess part of what I love about punk is that it's coming from this place of dissatisfaction. And I think there's a little bit of dissatisfaction in the indie scene, right? That, we don't all want to make space marines and elves in our games. But I think there's a little bit too much complacency. I think there's a few too many people who grew up playing platformers and are kind of reliving that through making indie platform games themselves today, right? I think there's more people coming from a place of nostalgia than there are coming from a place of really wanting to affect change. And I think that's what I ultimately mean when I say I want a little bit more anger.
Are there any indie game developers out there, working now that you would consider to be part of that sort of punk movement?
Sure. I mean, I think Anna Anthony's a great example, or, someone like Maddie Bryce as well is coming from that point of view. I think in a slightly different way, the kinds of work that Local Number 12, that's Colleen Macklin, Eric Zimmerman, and I's thing, where our games aren't outwardly angry, but they are coming from a place of being dissatisfied with what we see out there, both in terms of the way games integrate into people's lives, as well as the diversity of kinds of games that both the indie and the AAA scenes are producing. And so we're trying to respond to that. We're trying to fill voids that we see. We're trying to find new places for games and play in people's lives. So I think there are a lot of people like that. I think Ian Bagost is an interesting example. His whole Cow Clicker was a response to Facebook games, right? And then more recently, his Simony game is a critique of the whole sort of App Store iOS. And then, of course, Mullet Industria, Paolo Petrucini's games, completely coming from that sort of punk rock place of anger and dissatisfaction and trying to address these things through games.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring up Paolo Petrucci because he was on a panel at Indiecade East, I think on the first day on, oh, wow, the second day, Saturday. And he was on a panel with Richard Hoffmeyer and Ian Bogost and a journalist, I forget her name, that escapes me right now.
Heather Chaplin,
yes, thank you. And, I thought it was interesting because at one point they did bring up this idea of, games that are sort of advocacy and, how that can be a sort of self-defeating because the only people that are playing the games that are quote-unquote advocacy games are the people that agree with it. And so you sort of get this, it's sort of this loop that nobody is challenged by the game because they know what it's about. So can you speak to that? Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, I think that it is an issue, but I think it's, again, it's one of those things that's not unique to games. You know, the same thing happens with music, the same thing happens with art, with film, you know, that I doubt there were too many people that went and saw, you know, Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth that didn't already believe in global warming and climate change, you know. That's just it's a real challenge for all things to not just preach to the converted, so to speak. Now figuring out the strategies to get beyond that, you know, I think that's where the real work lies. And I think not everyone is necessarily up for that, because that's not necessarily about making games. That's about how you talk about games, how you present them, coming at it with not from a point of sort of self-righteous indignation that people don't get what you're talking about, but rather realizing that you're trying to help change people's perceptions and open their eyes. And so you need to come at them from more of a place of kind of humility and willing to teach them and not to wag your finger at them.
I think that's interesting. You know, it's funny you mention music, because I think, you know, music is an interesting example, especially with the punk scene. You know, a lot of people that like the music don't necessarily know that it's political, or sort of the music is angry, and I think that comes out in the actual music itself. And so I'm wondering if you think that there's any sort of like path there for games to be angry. Not necessarily in their subject matter or in the artist presentation of them, but in the actual game itself.
Yeah, and I think there is a space for anger in games. You know, I think there's a couple of pretty popular ones that already have that inside of them, like, say, football. You know, it's kind of has a space for that, right? So it's a matter of figuring out how do we translate that. I think there's a space for anger, let's say, inside of Johann Sebastian Joust, right? Though I don't think that's necessarily the kind of play experience Doug Wilson wants to happen inside that game. I think this space of possibility that it creates very much allows for that, right? Like, how did that's where I imagine the whole idea of kicking the controller out of your opponent's hand and Johann Sebastian Joust came from, right? Somebody bringing a little bit more aggression and a little bit more attitude to the play experience. But it's a good question, because, you know, one of the things that I love about games is that they're these sort of safe places to explore things. Now, how do you make a space that's safe for player exploration that still provides for anger in earnest, real anger, and not just sort of stylized or pretend anger? You know, it's a good question. You know, like, what would be the in-game equivalent of a mosh pit at a punk show?
I was about to ask, I mean, what lessons do you think that indie games can take from, you know, not the music, but the experience that all surrounded the punk scene, you know, the all ages thing, which you mentioned in your talk, making the shows affordable for people, and sort of having this, you know, understood rule system in place. I mean, yeah, mosh pits are sort of, you know, extremely crazy, and, you know, you don't get involved in them unless you know what you want to have happen. But there was sort of, you know, I'm thinking especially in terms of, you know, when Riot Girl started, and, you know, you have all these bands like, you know, Bikini Kill, to take a famous example, you know, Catherine Hanna would say things like, you know, bring the women up to the front, bring the girls up to the front, you know, don't harass them. I mean, she was really like out there and in your face. And I think you even mentioned in your talk in response to a question that you would like to see sort of this Riot Girl thing in games. Mm-hmm. So how do you think we translate that?
Well, I think part of it is we need to realize we're part of a community, and that are, for me, I guess I'm just very kind of engaged with that, you know, being someone who seems to constantly be in the middle of organizing one conference or another. Like, to me, I'm doing that because I want to help build a community. I want to make places for us to gather and to share. I think we one of the downsides of the developer sitting by herself in her bedroom is that you're sort of disconnected from that community, right? It reminds me more of what it was like to be a punk rock kid in the 1980s in a pre-internet era, where the only way to sort of find one another was to show up at the shows, right? And so I think we need to realize that community does matter, and that we need to create the spaces and the places and the events for us all to gather, both in person and online. And really, that just, that's part of our work, is sharing what we do and coming together and having, you know, the sort of the rituals and the rules about how we interact with one another.
So to bring this forward, then, I, you know, you're saying that, you know, online is great, but you really do need to have an offline space for these things to happen as well.
I feel pretty strongly about that, at least for myself, from my experience. I am part of some communities that only see one another once a year, you know, or twice a year. You know, the communities I'm part of that I basically see people during GDC, or I see them in during IndieCade. And other than that, our relationship remains online, you know, asynchronous through email or what have you. But I do feel like those face-to-face meeting times are important. I think that's part of what makes the New York scene work, is that, you know, at times we have these gathering places where everybody knows they're going to be. These days it tends to be, you know, maybe around the NYU Game Center Lecture Series or the Parsons New School Game Club meetups. Or I'm sitting in my office at school right now, and I'm looking out the door at a group of New York game scene folks out there playing board games together. Every Saturday, a group of them meet up here at Parsons and play from like noon till 2 or 3 in the afternoon. There's probably like 25, 30 people sitting out there, you know, having these opportunities to come together and play. To me, they're really, really important.
Well, John, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I've really enjoyed it.
Yes, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. You wanted to know where-